Welcome to the Science Podcast for February 1st, 2013. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, reinterpreting the carbon cycle, announcing the winners of our annual visualization challenge, and the collective behavior of fish.
Some people have hypothesized that by grouping together, animals may act like a sensory array, which can amplify the signal in the cues and at the same time filter out the noise.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
At every waypoint in the carbon cycle, like plant respiration, sediment burial, and deep sea sinks, carbon isotopes become fractionated, and oxidation reduction conditions yield varying levels of oxygen in the atmosphere. It's the preservation of all of these biogeochemical signatures that allows scientists to use today's rocks to peer back in time to the carbon cycles of the past. After examining gaps in the traditional view of the carbon cycle, John Higgins and colleagues now reinterpret the model to account for a previously overlooked carbon sink. I spoke with Higgins about how he approached this problem.
We're used to thinking about the carbon cycle on very long, you know, million-year timescales as a balance between the amount of carbon that's buried as organic matter, organic carbon like plants and animals, and the carbon that is buried in calcium carbonate, things like coral reefs. Now, organic carbon and calcium carbonate incorporate different amounts of the isotopes of carbon, carbon-12 and carbon-13. And so by looking at the ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-13 and calcium carbonate rocks through time, we actually can use this to reconstruct how much of the carbon is being buried as organic carbon, is being buried as calcium carbonate. And the important point here is that the burial of organic carbon, it releases atmospheric oxygen, or releases oxygen. And so when we look at the record and we see changes or variability in the ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-13, we've largely interpreted these as changes in atmospheric oxygen. And what we propose in this paper is kind of a new way of looking at this variability that still in some ways depends on oxygen, but depends on it in a very different way. And that is through the introduction of kind of a new type of carbonate burial that occurs in shallow sediments. And the carbon for that calcium carbonate is largely derived from the respiration of organic carbon. And so then when we look at these variations in carbon-12 to carbon-13 in the geologic record that we have, you know, traditionally interpreted as changes in organic carbon burial and changes thus in atmospheric oxygen, we're now saying that in fact we can look at these variations as changes in the amount of this new carbonate sink. And this is related to atmospheric oxygen and the amount of oxygen that's dissolved in the ocean, but it's related to it indirectly.
So we have, you know, a relatively complicated system. We have a couple of different kinds of carbon. And then, of course, oxidation and reduction conditions. All of these things are helping us to determine how much carbon is being buried and such. So why did this whole notion of the carbon cycle warrant a reexamination on your part?
Well, it largely comes from the fact that the more data that's been collected over the last 10 or 20 years has really filled in the kind of geologic record in terms of the variability in the ratio of carbon-12 to 13 in calcium carbonate through time. And what's been revealed is that these variations are much larger and occur over much longer timescales than we really had thought of and encountered before. Mm-hmm. And the duration and kind of the extreme nature of these variations is really hard to understand in the context of these changes in organic carbon burial and changes in atmospheric oxygen. You know, basically it requires much too much oxygen to be produced during some times and much too much oxygen to be consumed during some times. And so it stretched the limits of what is really realistic about how we think about the history of the atmosphere and the history of oxygen in the atmosphere in the past. And so what this paper is really doing is we're adding another way of causing these variations in the record that is related in a different way to oxygen. It's related indirectly through the effect of oxygen on the ability of calcium carbonate with a very different ratio of carbon-12 to 13 that looks much more like organic matter to be an important component of this system.
So tell me about what this other variable is.
So this other variable is what we call in the paper, we call it orthogenic carbonate. Traditionally, we think of calcium carbonate as, you know, precipitating in the ocean and raining down onto the seafloor and then getting buried. And there are a lot of observations going back in the geologic record that suggest that there's actually a lot of calcium carbonate that isn't precipitated in the surface ocean and rain to the sediments, but actually precipitates in the sediments itself. Hmm. And the key part here is that within the sediments is where we get a lot of organic matter that gets respired and turned back into CO2. And so that affects the ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-13 in the pore fluids of the sediment. And so where this new orthogenic carbonate is precipitating is not from the well-mixed ocean, but is from these very shallow sediment pore fluids. And so the sink of calcium carbonate, which had been observed in the past, but people typically, you know, discarded these samples or thought they represented some sort of alteration and didn't reflect the actual state of the system, we're arguing that, in fact, this sink has been much more important in the past, in the geologic past, than people realize.
So does this patch up all of the holes in our understanding of the carbon cycle?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think that this provides a very new way of looking at and thinking about a lot of these variations in carbon 12 to 13 that we see in the record. But at this stage, this is an idea about how to explain the record. What really it begs is to go back and to try to quantify this and to disentangle the changes in carbon 12 to carbon 13 and in calcium carbonate that are driven by changes in the size of this orthogenic carbonate sink, or the amount of carbon being buried as orthogenic carbonate, versus changes in carbon 12 to carbon 13 driven by the old formula, so driven by the burial of organic carbon and changes in atmospheric oxygen. So it's not really replacing the old framework, but rather, you know, recalibrating it and making it more consistent with what we think the observations are.
And so in the geologic record, what do orthogenic carbonates look like? How are they differentiated from, you know, other carbonate minerals formed in other ways?
So it can look like a variety of things. It can look like the other carbonate that we look at. And part of the difficulty, I think, is distinguishing between calcium carbonate that we believe is precipitated in the ocean versus calcium carbonate that's precipitated in these shallow sediments. And sometimes this difference is very obvious. There are certain types of characteristics of the sediment that are very indicative of the fact that there is precipitation going on there. So things like cements, and cements are just calcium carbonate that binds other bits of sediment or calcium carbonate together. And the abundance of these cements through time appeared to decrease. And so one observation is the presence of these cements and their abundance in the geologic record. But overall, it's a bit of a challenge to disentangle the two. And in fact, you know, part of the problem has been is that a lot of geologists, when they go out there and very carefully try to reconstruct the carbon cycle and look at the carbon isotopic composition of carbonate rocks, they can see a lot of these samples that show anomalously or very different carbon isotope values, the stuff that we're calling orthogenic carbonate, and they kind of tend to dismiss them as reflecting some late stage process or as a minor component. And what we're actually saying is that as you go back in time, this minor component, or what looks like a minor component today, has actually becomes a much more substantial component.
And why would the amount of orthogenic carbonate being mineralized have changed over time?
So this is where we actually go back and connect it to oxygen. And so it does have to do with oxygen and the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere and the amount of oxygen in the ocean. And that's because today the role of oxygen in the ocean is that you have the respiration of organic carbon in sediments, consuming oxygen and producing CO2. And this is the respiration that all of us do. And this CO2 acts as an acid, and that tends to dissolve much of the carbonate sediment that is rained down and deposited on the seafloor. And so today we have about 75%, 50 to 75% of the carbonate that is produced in the ocean is actually redissolved in the sediments. And so as you go back in time, as you go back into the geologic record, atmospheric oxygen in the Precambrian and further back in time was much lower than it is today. And that lower atmospheric oxygen translated into less acid being produced in sediments. And it's even a little bit more complicated than this in the sense that organic carbon can be respired by other oxidants, things like sulfate and nitrate. And it turns out when you use those oxidants to oxidize organic matter, that you actually induce or drive the precipitation of calcium carbonate. So more or less, the decline in orthogenic carbonates through time is related to the rise of atmospheric oxygen and the effect of that on the acidity of the sediments, more or less.
Okay, so now that we've introduced this carbon sink in the form of orthogenic carbonates, how does this now influence our evaluation of the carbon cycle in the past? Do we need to reinterpret anything?
When we go back into the past, it gives us a way to look at these excursions in kind of a new light. You know, no longer do we have to attribute all the variability that we see in the ratio of carbon 12 to 13 as burial of organic carbon and changes in atmospheric oxygen. It gives us another lever to which to look at those. In some ways, it reconciles the record of carbon 12 to carbon 13 with a more realistic understanding of what variations the carbon cycle has likely undergone.
And does it affect our predictions of what's happening with the carbon cycle in the near and the far out future?
Well, I don't think it has much to bear on anthropogenic climate change and the emission of CO2 into the atmosphere by the burning of fossil fuels. It much more bears on how we understand and interpret the carbon cycle on these very long timescales. And so it helps us, for example, to perhaps understand the kinds of changes that we see after the Permo-Triassic boundary, which is the greatest mass extinction in the geologic record. And there are lots of interesting wiggles, basically, in the ratio of carbon 12 to carbon 13 in the aftermath of this big extinction. And there's been quite a debate as to what these wiggles mean. And what we relate them to then is changes in kind of the size or the amount of orthogenic carbonate driven by changes in the oxidation state of the ocean.
Great. Well, John Higgins, thank you so much.
Thank you.
John Higgins and colleagues write about reconfiguring the carbon cycle in a research article this week. Hey, everybody. This week's show is sponsored by Audible.com. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag, you can get a free audiobook of your choice.
But in case you're having difficulty deciding, we decided we'd give you a few recommendations to go with the themes of this week's show. As usual, I can't get away from the classics. I found On the Origin of Species by Charles Darwin, narrated by Richard Dawkins. It's definitely worth a listen. And what about you, Carrie?
Well, I'm a bit of a rock nerd, so I went with Basin and Range, Annals of the Former World, Book 1, by John McPhee. It's part of a Pulitzer Prize-winning series he wrote all about the geology of North America.
Okay, well, check out these books and more from Audible and get your free download just for signing up with audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag. Not everyone has the brains to stay out of the rain, and not all fish have the cognitive ability to sense and integrate environmental cues all on their own. In a report this week, Andrew Burdall and colleagues attempt to determine how collective behavior, like the schooling of fish, can substitute for the advanced sensing and integrating that might not be available to tiny fish like the golden shiner. I spoke with Burdall about how these fish form a so-called sensing array.
So all over the world, organisms need to move around to find the things they need to survive. And luckily for them, many of these resources are connected to detectable cues, such as chemical concentration or temperature. Mm-hmm. However, unfortunately for them, the world's quite messy, and these cues are often mixed up and noisy, and so they're difficult to follow. Some people have hypothesized that by grouping together, animals may act like a sensory array, which can amplify the signal in the cues and at the same time filter out the noise. So we set out to test for this form of collective sensing using some highly social schooling fish, which prefer darker habitat, and we can manipulate that habitat in the lab. Basically, we found in the end that as group size increases, the ability to which fish could find and remain in darker habitat increased.
Let's start with a little background. So collective sensing could be considered a subset of collective intelligence. What does it mean for people and in animals to have collective intelligence?
Although it might sound a little bit silly, one of the best examples of collective intelligence is just regular intelligence. In your brain, you have billions of individual neurons, and each one is sort of a simpleton, at least compared to you.
Right.
You certainly wouldn't want to try to drive your car just using one at a time. But you also wouldn't want to try to use your brain, even using all of the billions of neurons at once, if they were acting independently. It's the connections and the interactions between the individual neurons, not just their sheer numbers, that give rise to your intelligence. But probably what you mean and what most people mean when they refer to collective intelligence is when a group of animals or humans have their ability to solve some problem increased by working together. Mm-hmm. As a group.
So for your study, you looked at how a school of social fish or a school of fish acts collectively to stay in darker water. What type of methods did you use to determine which factors were important for this group behavior?
Okay, this study involved a nice mix of experimental and theoretical techniques. As our experimental subjects, we used a group of small schooling fish called golden shiners. These fish really like to school, and they also prefer darker, shady habitat. So we'd put these fish in a large, shallow tank, and just like at the movies where the film is projected on a big screen, mm-hmm. we projected a movie of different habitats for the fish down onto the bottom of their tank. So the habitats in this movie were really just dark and light patches, which move around and sometimes disappear and then reappear elsewhere. So the task for the fish then was to find these darker areas, which they like, and to stay in them as they move around. The fish were difficult to see in the dark areas, which is probably why they like to go there. So we couldn't use regular cameras to film the experiments. Instead, we filmed them with infrared light and then developed some computer vision software to track the fish's trajectories throughout the experiments. So this allowed us to figure out how well the fish in different group sizes were able to track the dark patches. And we found that the bigger groups were much more effective at finding and remaining in these dark patches. So we wanted to sort of figure out why that was. So we took the trajectories of each fish and broke it down into how much their movements were being influenced by their environment, mm-hmm. that is moving towards nearby dark patches, and how much they were influenced by the movements and positions of their neighbors. And we found somewhat surprisingly that the fish didn't seem to be using their own local information about the light gradient at all. Rather, they were strongly influenced by the positions of their neighbors, which, of course, you might expect for a strongly schooling fish.
So you're saying that the trajectory indicated that they are more interested in what their neighbor was doing than, say, I see some darkness up ahead, and that's where I want to go.
Yes. So their turning was mostly related to the positions of their neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't pay attention to the direction of the nearest dark patch very much.
Okay.
Another thing that popped out of the data, and that we actually just observed while we were conducting the experiments, was the fish really tended to slow down when they were in the dark patches and speed up when they were in lighter areas. So we sort of had two dominant influences on the fish, the first of which was social interactions, primarily through attraction towards their neighbors. We also had this speeding up and slowing down, but not necessarily changing the direction in response to the local light level.
So can you describe how those two forces work together to allow the group to navigate towards the darker places?
Yeah, so we can do a little bit of a thought experiment here. Let's imagine that the school is a Segway, like one of those two-wheeled vehicles you might see a mall cop using.
Yep.
So imagine it's traveling along, but one side is in the darker preferred area, and the other side is in the not-so-preferred light area. Mm-hmm. So we know from our experiments that the fish in the lighter area will move faster, so we can imagine the wheel on the lighter side spinning faster. Now, if there are just two independent wheels, that faster wheel would just pull ahead and leave the other one behind, still with them both traveling parallel to each other. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't happen because the wheels, though they may turn at different rates, are attached by an axle. We can think of the axle as the social forces that hold the fish school together. Mm-hmm. So now when we imagine the Segway's wheels turning at different rates but being connected by the axle, mm-hmm. this will cause the entire vehicle or the entire school to turn towards the slower side, which is also the darker side.
So that's the mechanism for, say, a school of fish moving around inside of a reef or, you know, around on the ocean floor. But you also suggest that this mechanism might be at work for much longer migrations. How would that work?
So, yeah, we demonstrated here that this mechanism might allow fish to stay within a local preferred region. And many fish, say, in the ocean, have a preferred temperature of water they would like to stay in. But due to seasonality of the planet, this band of preferred temperature may travel a great distance over the course of year. So by using the mechanism we've outlined here to stay within a certain preferred region, the animals may make a long migration as that preferred region moves around the world.
Uh-huh. So as part of the study, you actually replicated this behavior in a synthetic system, assigning these behaviors to a virtual system and then seeing if they behave the same way as the live school of fish. You also mentioned that this might be something that applies beyond animal behavior. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah, like you said, we used computers to simulate simplified fish just to test out as a proof of principle whether the couple simple ingredients I've outlined would cause this collective motion towards the darkness. But bio-inspired robotics is a rapidly growing field. And in fact, we already have collaborators at Georgia Tech who have used our speed differential algorithm and put it into little robots who, when they put them together in groups, can run around the lab and find dark or light areas, even though they don't have any ability to move towards those areas on their own. So their hope is to develop this sort of idea into swarms of mobile sensors, which could be deployed in the ocean and, you know, swim around and detect and monitor things like pollution spills or algae blooms.
Wow.
Because the algorithm is so simple, these robots would be cheap and easy to mass produce.
Well, since this is an individual behavior, but it also requires a group, how might something like this have arisen through evolution?
Well, that's a really good question, Sarah, especially since these fish aren't necessarily highly related. So we can't rely on things like inclusive fitness to explain them seemingly working together. Now, of course, the benefits of their collective sensing may contribute to the fitness advantage that may lead to grouping. But independent of that, there are strong benefits for grouping, such as predator avoidance. So we can say, even in the absence of this collective sensing, animals will form groups for reasons like protection. Now, the other ingredient we need is for them to slow down in preferred areas. But that's an entirely sensible and selfish strategy that we would just expect to find in any animal, grouping or independent. So really, independently, we get both of the ingredients we need for the collective sensing. And so the sensing comes for free, evolutionarily speaking.
All right. Well, Andrew Berdahl, thank you so much for talking with me.
Sarah, it's been a pleasure. I really appreciate the invitation.
Andrew Berdahl and colleagues write about schooling behavior in this week's Science. As technology evolves, so do the means and the need for effective visual communication in the sciences. This week, we honor some of the more outstanding visualizations around with the announcement of the winners of the International Science and Engineering Visualization Challenge, co-sponsored by Science and the National Science Foundation. Speaking with some of the participants, Carrie Klein takes a look at the intersection of art and science.
Pipette, paintbrush, left brain, right brain. Science and art seem to fall into completely different bins, but are the two really so different? Tackling this dichotomy head-on is the International Science and Engineering Visualization Challenge, which invites scientists, engineers, and mathematicians to bring out their artistic sides.
These entries are really designed to celebrate breaking scientific discoveries in an aesthetic, artistic, beautiful, effective manner.
Tierney Teese, a scientist, educator, and media maker, is one of the competition's judges. And the media she's talking about include illustrations, photographs, posters, graphics, videos, games, and the newest category, apps. This year's 211 entries hail from 18 countries and 18 U.S. states. The 15 winners cover a broad swath of topics, from the anatomy of seeds to the connectivity of the human brain to the 4.6 billion-year history of the planet. While some aim to educate, others take steps towards solving scientific problems and answering long-standing questions. But what they all have in common is an emphasis on visual communication.
I think so much insight and inspiration can happen when the boundaries between art and science are torn down and they're taught concurrently as partners in discovery instead of as these separate entities.
Indeed, in both of these fields, many modern artists and scientists view their work similarly as channels for discussion, education, and problem solving. And sometimes the one helps facilitate the messages of the other. One researcher whose work would be a whole lot more difficult without imagery is Pupa Gilbert, a biophysicist from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She studies biominerals, or the crystals formed by living organisms, things like bones, shells, and exoskeletons. Her first-placed photograph features curved, flowing tendrils in blues, purples, and greens, strings of blown glass, perhaps, or a tangle of tropically colored seaweed. But it's probably not what you think.
What you're looking at is the forming part of a searching tooth, and it tells a story about evolution, form, and function in a very effective and, I believe, surprising way.
When Gilbert sat down to examine these teeth under a microscope, she expected to see crystal faces that mimicked the jagged sharpness of the teeth themselves.
it was completely surprising that they would actually have such beautifully rounded shapes that are so perfectly imbricated and intertwined so that they manage to fill space.
Sea urchin teeth are made of calcium carbonate, a mineral that precipitates out of seawater. As their teeth wear away and reform, new calcium carbonate fills in the empty space amorphously, without any form. Then, when the carbonate becomes crystalline, it retains the unstructured form it initially took, an unusual type of mineralization in organisms. And the judges picked up not only on this photo's visual appeal, but on the discovery behind it.
It really broadened your concept of what a crystal is and could be. I mean, we tend to think of crystals as these sort of rather rectilineal, sharp-edged, flat-faced entities. But that just isn't the case when it comes to biomineral crystals.
This original photograph was black and white, but Gilbert says the shapes and forms can be spotted much more easily in color. A transformation, she says, is essential for communicating something as esoteric as the crystals within our bones.
This is a bit of a hobby of mine. I really love art. I'm an art collector. I also wrote a book about art and science that's called Physics in the Arts. So, you know, it's like my theme.
And, she says, the turquoise taking center stage in her photo is one of her favorite colors to work with. Another winner in this year's challenge embodies a different form of science visualization. Michael Rubenstein, a PhD candidate at MIT, studies computer vision and image processing. His honorable mention video demonstrates a new technology that can parse out the patterns hiding in videos of the mundane.
There's a whole world of small changes that we cannot normally perceive or see, and we wanted to amplify them and make them apparent.
Small changes like the minute fluctuations in skin color as the heart beats, and the normally imperceptible oscillations of buildings in the breeze. The video features almost comically exaggerated examples of these phenomena. A man's face rhythmically reddening with his pulse, and a construction crane wobbling dangerously above a skyscraper. Not animations, but simply exaggerations of patterns that already exist. How does it work?
So you can think about it as a type of equalizer that you usually apply to an audio signal to tune it. But here we apply it to the signal of intensity levels recorded at every pixel in our video over time, and then boost some of the frequencies in that signal, either to amplify parts of the video or remove parts of the video.
So you take a video, say, of your wrist. Not too interesting on its own, right? But tune Rubenstein's analysis tool to the frequency of your heartbeat, and a built-in algorithm analyzes the changes at each pixel and amplifies the movements of the veins in your wrist so that they look like they're trying to jump right out of your skin.
That was the big wow factor, absolutely, that these tiny, imperceptible changes in color could then be extrapolated out to so much more information. So I thought that was just a real eye-opener, that video.
Among other applications, Rubenstein and his colleagues envisioned doctors using this tool to collect vital signs non-invasively. But he gets some ideas from his everyday life as well.
There's a new father who used this fancy baby monitor with a motion sensor that can indicate whether the baby is breathing. Usually those things suffer from false positives. You know, back then when I was a new father, I was very oriented towards this direction, and I could imagine, you know, using this type of tool to augment existing baby monitors.
The beauty of the algorithm is its accessibility. It can extract patterns from the most amateur of videos, even ones taken with smartphones and cheap cameras. And for right now, the code is available online for free for non-commercial purposes. It's been well received so far, and some users have applied it in ways that Rubenstein and his team hadn't even considered.
So, for example, I got this link to a video made by this guy who wanted to amplify fetal motions during his wife's pregnancy.
To Tierney Teese, the kinds of advances demonstrated in Rubenstein's video and many other entries reflect an ongoing trend she's observed during the years she's been judging this competition.
So as we get more tools available, then we just get a greater degree of resolution in many of these photographs and greater insight and aspects of the subject matter that were never possible to be seen before. You know, there's all sorts of new avenues that have opened up with these new techniques.
A medium that's only recently begun to see scientific applications is video games, which Teese considers to be the wave of the future in education. In Untangled, this year's People's Choice winning game, users are given a grid and must compete to create compact, efficient computer circuits, part of a new trend in games that crowdsource users to solve real-world problems.
And I love games that are helping citizens, training citizens in particular skills that could be used by scientists. I love games like that.
This year's first place poster harkens back to a time when science visualization meant hand-drawn medical illustrations. And according to Teese, the key to this poster's effectiveness is the simplicity of the question that it answers.
How on earth can an owl turn its head 280 degrees in either direction without cutting off blood supply to its brain? It's such a fundamental question. When we can only turn our heads maybe 160, at the most 180 degrees, unless, of course, we're Linda Blair.
So, what's your research all about? How do you describe it to your friends? Would it make a good video game? If you're unsure about whether or not your work lends itself to these kinds of visualizations, consider this question.
If you don't share your science, what good is it?
For Science, this is Carrie Klein.
Carrie Klein spoke with Tierney Teese, Pupa Gilbert, and Michael Rubenstein about this year's International Science and Engineering Visualization Challenge. You can read, watch, and play all of this year's winners at www.sciencemag.org/special/viz2012. Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor for Science, is here to give us a rundown of some of the stories from our daily news site. So first up, Dave, we have my favorite of the bunch, which is a new insight into how pigeons navigate.
Right. Well, Sarah, you know, we know actually a lot about how birds navigate. We know that they use a variety of senses, sight, smell. Birds even seem to have an internal compass that helps them align with Earth's magnetic fields. Now, this new paper suggests that birds actually have an additional sense where they can sense something called infrasound.
So what's infrasound? Is it like infrared?
Kind of, because the type of sound that actually is mostly outside of our hearing range, just like sort of infrared is outside of our visual range. It's very low-level background noise in our atmosphere. And here's an example. Here's a clip of an earthquake. And mostly what you're going to be hearing is earthquake sounds, but there's actually a bit of infrasound mixed in there that's within the range that we can actually hear.
Okay, that gives me the creeps.
And actually, what they say about infrasound is it actually does give a lot of people the creeps and actually gives a lot of animals the creeps, too. So be careful about playing this podcast near any pets.
Do pigeons actually hear in the infrasound range?
That was the question that motivated this study and actually came about because a researcher was intrigued by the unexplained loss of almost 60,000 pigeons during a race from France to England.
I think it's a pigeon race.
What was interesting about the race was that the birds that became lost were on the same flight path as the Concorde, which had been flying at the time. And the Concorde actually laid down a sonic boom carpet, which masked the infrasound that the birds rely on, or at least what this researcher suspected the birds relied on. And that's why he believes they got lost, although he didn't have any proof beyond just that anecdotal observation.
So did he use the Concorde for his testing?
He didn't. He went to a few sites in upstate New York, and he modeled the infrasound signatures that were generated around three sites where homing pigeons are released to sort of get a sense of what sort of the background infrasound is. And then he compared the flight data from the pigeons released to some sound wave diagrams that he had made of the infrasound. And what he found when he did a bunch of computer modeling was that the pigeons were orienting with the sound map, which suggested they were actually using infrasound as a way to navigate.
Huh. Well, is this something that can be applied further? Will infrasound maps be useful to people?
Well, not sure about people, but what the scientists say is it may not just be pigeons that can hear infrasound. It may be other animals. We know dolphins, for example, use echolocation to find their way around and to find objects. Perhaps them and other marine mammals, because infrasound is something that's very present underwater, maybe they use infrasound as well to navigate in addition to the other senses they use too. So something that's going to require a bit more investigation.
Great. So next up, we have a story of the microbiome, again, making headlines. This time, we're talking about populations of bacteria in the sky.
Yes. This is one of my favorite stories, speaking of our favorite stories. This is definitely pretty wacky. And what this has to do with is researchers are saying that billions of bacteria and other microorganisms may actually be living up in the atmosphere.
Wow. Okay. So why would they do that?
Well, we already know that each year, hundreds of millions of metric tons of dust and water and other human pollutants make their way into the atmosphere. The winds and the pressure just has a way of sort of creating this escalator, if you will, that just lifts a lot of stuff from Earth's surface up into the atmosphere. So it's, in a sense, it's not a surprise that we would find microbes up there as well. And indeed, when researchers took part in 9 NASA airplane flights that were aimed at studying hurricanes, the researchers actually grabbed some air samples as well. And what they found was that there were thousands and thousands of airborne microorganisms floating in the troposphere, which is about 10 kilometers above Earth, and they were specifically looking over the Caribbean.
So that's what's new here, is that there's more variety and more bacteria than expected?
Well, first of all, they're confirming that these microorganisms are actually up there, and there is a lot of variety. And what was actually the most surprising was that 60% of these microbes were still alive. So they weren't just sort of microbe detritus that was sort of wafted up into the atmosphere. These guys were actually alive 10 kilometers above Earth's surface. And what was the most interesting was that the researchers kept on finding a lot of the same bacteria, a lot of the same types of bacteria in their samples. And that suggests that there may be types of bacteria that have actually evolved to live in the sky. And in fact, some of them seem to feed on oxalic acid, which is one of the most abundant chemical compounds in the sky.
Wow.
So one of the suggestions is there may be even this ecosystem in the sky where you've got these bacteria up there, they're floating up there, they're feeding up there, they're maybe even reproducing up there. You can imagine that this whole sort of world happening up in the clouds that we were previously unaware of.
So do they actually have anything to do with us, though? Are they making us sick? Are they, you know, are they just, transplanting from continent to continent?
First of all, this idea has a lot of skepticism. Some researchers are saying researchers just happen to find them while they've been lifted up in the air. They actually aren't spending a lot of time up there. And what they're really doing is just sort of moving from place to place. So they're either getting lifted up into the troposphere, they're landing maybe on another continent, and then they are landing back on the ground and doing whatever they do down there. And the air is just sort of a transport for them. It's not actually a destination.
That would be really hard to test.
One would think. And one thing they actually might be doing, as amazing as it sounds, is actually seeding clouds up there. These microbes are about the right size and texture to cause water vapor to condense or even form ice around them, which would mean that these things aren't just living in the clouds. They may actually be making the clouds themselves.
Yeah, this one might actually be my favorite.
Yeah, I'm glad I could convince you.
So last up, we have another adaptation story, in this case, adapting to the severe weather of Siberia.
Well, Sarah, Siberia is probably not a place you'd want to hang out in it for a long time. Only about 0.5% of the world's population lives in Siberia, and that's with good reason. In January, the temperatures averaged negative 25 degrees Celsius.
That's cold.
But people live there, and this new study is trying to figure out how have humans adapted to live in these very, very cold climates.
As you say, it's a really tiny portion of the planet actually lives in Siberia. Well, who do they get to participate in their study?
Well, there are a lot of native people that actually live there. These people, a lot of them can trace their ancestry back up to 25,000 years ago. So these are populations that have been in this area for a long, long time. And that means their DNA, hypothetically, has a chance to evolve over time to make them more adaptable to this very cold climate. What this new study is trying to show is, can scientists sort of see evolution in action? Can they see changes in the genes of these people that would suggest that they really have adapted over these thousands of years to this very frigid region of Earth?
So what kind of adaptations did they find?
Well, they found mutations in 3 genes. One was a gene called UCP1, which has previously been shown to help the body's fat stores directly produce heat rather than producing chemical energy for muscle movements or brain functions. It sort of sidesteps those processes and goes straight to generating heat, which you can imagine would be very important if you're freezing to death.
Right.
And they found a couple other mutations in genes called ENPP7 and PRKG1. And PRKG1 is involved in the contraction of smooth muscle, which is key to shivering, the constriction of blood vessels, which helps us avoid heat loss. The other gene, ENPP7, is implicated in the metabolism of fats, especially those in meat and dairy products. And that's interesting because a lot of the people that live in this area have diets that are very rich in fat. So this gene might really help them digest that food.
So were all of these genes found in all of these populations?
Some of the differences were more prevalent in certain populations versus other populations.
Another group that might actually share these mutations are Neanderthals and Denisovans.
And even actually Native Americans, because all of these groups lived in what is today Siberia at one time, which suggests that they actually may also have indications in their DNA that show that they, like the native people that live there today, evolved to live in this very harsh climate.
Wow. So what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about whether humans are built to be lazy. Speaking of evolution in action, also a story about how fish think. For Science Insider, we've got an item about a U.S. team that has retrieved samples from a buried lake in Antarctica. Also a story about the fate of America's last atom smasher. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about the science of gun violence. What are we learning about the impact of guns on society and the role of scientific research in learning more about guns and gun violence in the United States and elsewhere. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave. David Grimm is the editor for Science's online daily news site. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the February 1st, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.